If you would, be turning in your Bibles to 1 Kings chapter 18. 1 Kings chapter 18. We'll be drawing most of our lesson this morning from 1 Kings 18 and 1 Kings 19. What I want to talk about for a few minutes this morning is the idea of overcoming discouragement. And as we begin to talk about the idea of discouragement, we need to realize it happens. It comes upon every person at some point, usually based upon some circumstances that we're facing. We're going to face some kind of discouragement. And sometimes what happens is that we get stuck in our discouragement. We have a hard time being able to lift ourselves out of it. We have a hard time figuring out how to stop the downward spiral that seems to happen whenever discouragement comes our way. And a lot of times we end up in a place where it's more than we're just having a bad day. It's that we are truly in a state of discouragement. And the only way that we can get out of that is to make a conscious decision that we're going to escape it. We're going to do something to get ourselves out of that situation and move into a better situation to be able to help ourselves overcome the idea of discouragement. But I would say that knowing how to break that cycle is important. It's one thing to say you need to do it, and it's another thing completely to say this is how you accomplish that. This is how you overcome the discouragement that might be in our lives. Now, I've had situations where I've dealt with people and talked with people and tried to help people who were in serious states of depression. That's not what we're talking about this morning. I'm talking about what we all, those cycles that we all go through from time to time. There are going to be circumstances that cause us to become discouraged in the things that we're trying to accomplish, especially when we're talking about trying to do the work of the Lord. Sometimes we become discouraged. And in the process of that, we need to know how to overcome that, how to get out of that type of a discouragement. And we want to use 1 Kings chapter, really chapters 18 and 19, to figure out maybe how God would have us to overcome that discouragement. To kind of set the background for what we're going to be talking about, we want to go back and look a little bit into chapter 17, or at least mention chapter 17, in which there is this time in which Elijah the prophet has prayed to God that there be no rain in Israel. Now, in 1 Kings chapter 17, it's just stated as a fact. Elijah says, there's not going to be any rain. James chapter 5 and verse 17 tells us that he prayed earnestly that it would not rain on the land. And of course, Elijah's prayer was granted by God, and so we get into chapter 18, and again from James chapter 5 and verse 17, we learn that it has been 3.5 years since it rained. He prayed earnestly that it would not rain, and it did not rain for 3.5 years. It is about that time that Elijah has already fled into the wilderness and he's been hiding from King Ahab because King Ahab's not real happy with him that such a thing has happened. He's the one that has brought the message that it was not going to happen, and so it was all Elijah's fault, and so Elijah is kind of hiding away in the wilderness. And lo and behold, he comes upon the man Obadiah, and he meets him there in the wilderness, and Obadiah is a good man. Obadiah is one who fears God, but he is also the leader over Ahab's household. And of course, Ahab was one of the most wicked kings that had ever served in Israel. But Obadiah was a good man. In fact, he was such a good man that even when there was persecution of the prophets of God, Obadiah took 100 of them, split them into 2 groups of 50 and hid them in caves and made sure that they had the provisions they need to survive while that persecution was going on. And so Elijah meets this man Obadiah. And he is going to tell Obadiah that he needs to go and get Ahab and bring him back. Let's look down in chapter 18 and verse 9. This is Obadiah's response. Verse 8, he answered and said to him, "It is I." This is Obadiah has asked Elijah, "Is that you?" in the preceding verses. Verse 8 says, Elijah speaking, "It is I. Go tell your master Elijah is here. So he, that is Obadiah, said, how have I sinned that you are delivering your servant into the hand of Ahab to kill me? Why should I go and tell Ahab that you're here? You can read some of the following verses in Obadiah. It makes a pretty compelling argument. He says, now I know you're not going to do something to intentionally, but the Spirit of God might whisk you away. And he might take you someplace else. And if Ahab comes here and he finds that you're not here, he's going to kill me. And Elijah assures him, you don't have to worry about that. I am here to meet Ahab. And so he insists that Ahab be brought. And so Obadiah goes and finds Ahab and he brings him back to meet Elijah. And let's see what he says there in verse 17. So Ahab comes to Elijah. He recognizes Elijah. And it says there in the latter half of verse 17, Ahab said to him, is that you, O troubler of Israel? Are you the one that's caused all these problems? And of course the answer was no. Now it was easy to blame Elijah because Elijah was the messenger. Elijah was the one who said that this is what was going to happen. Elijah was even the one that prayed that it was going to happen because this is what Israel needed. But it wasn't just Elijah that was causing the problem. He wasn't the troubler of Israel. In fact, look at what he says in verse 18. This is Elijah answering, I have not troubled Israel, but you and your father's house have, and that you have forsaken the commandments of the Lord and have followed the Baals. Ahab, it's not me that's the troubler of Israel, it's you. You've fallen into this idolatry, you're continuing in this idolatry, and you're the one that's causing the problems. So all of this leads to Elijah challenging the false prophets there at Mount Carmel. He tells Ahab to bring your prophets. Bring those 450 prophets of Baal. Bring those 400 prophets of the Asherah. And we're going to have this challenge. And we're going to see whose God is the real God. We're going to see who it is that can defend His people. And so what Elijah tells these false prophets to do is to take a bull, and they're each going to take one. Elijah has one, and the false prophets have one, and they're going to cut it up into pieces, they're going to lay it on the altar, and then they call upon their gods to light the fires. Which God is powerful enough to light the fires to consume the sacrifices that had been made? And of course, those of the prophets of the Baal and the Asherah weren't able to coax any fire out from their gods because they're not real gods. They weren't really there. And so they couldn't light the fire for their people. And what we see in this context is that those prophets just made fools out of themselves. Look down in chapter 18 there in verse 27. Says, and so it was at noon, this is that they had been going on. Let's just back up to verse 26. He says, so they took the bull which was given them, and they prepared it, and called on the name of Baal from morning until noon, saying, O Baal, hear us. But there was no voice, and no one answered. Then they leaped about the altar which they had made. And so it was at noon that Elijah mocked them, and said, cry aloud, for he is a god. Either he's meditating, or he's busy, or he's on a journey, or perhaps he's sleeping, and he needs to be awakened. So they cried aloud and cut themselves, as was their custom, with knives and lances, until the blood gushed out of them. This was their normal practice, to make fools of themselves in the display of serving their God. But when it came Elijah's time, what we see is that he took the time to repair the altar of the Lord. And then he dug a trench around the altar. And then he poured 12 water pots of water over the sacrifice to fill up the trench with water. What he was about to do was to show just how mighty his God was. He was going to show it wasn't just a matter of some freak occurrence that was going to happen that caused his to suddenly be lit afire. It was going to be a mighty display from God. Drop down to verse 38. It says, then the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt sacrifice and the wood and the stones and the dust, and it licked up the water that was in the trench. Now when all the people saw it, they fell on their faces and they said, the Lord, He is God. The Lord, He is God. Can you imagine being there and witnessing this? I imagine the frightfulness of it would make it so that we really wouldn't wanted to have been there. We wouldn't have wanted to actually see what was taking place. It was such a devastating sight and display that God was showing through Elijah here. In the wake of this great victory, Elijah called upon the people of Israel to help him to round up the prophets. He told them to get them all. He told them to take them down to the brook Kishon. And you look at verse 40, it says that Elijah brought them down to the brook Kishon and executed them there. Here was the one prophet of God who was able to overcome the 450 prophets of Baal, the 400 prophets of the Asherah. And he was able to display the power of God and come out victorious on the other side. And so what we see is a situation which it seems all is well for Elijah. All is fantastic. Everything was going his way. God was on his side. What could possibly go wrong? But what we see is that that high didn't last very long. That victory didn't last very long for Elijah, because what goes from being an extreme high becomes an extreme low almost immediately. The victory is cut down for him. And so then we begin in chapter 19 to see the discouragement that Elijah was facing. In chapter 19, the first couple of verses, what we learn is that Jezebel, the wife of King Ahab, set her sights on Elijah. She became determined that she was going to destroy Elijah. In fact, look at how she puts it in verse 2. Then Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah saying, "So let the gods do to me and more also if I do not make your life as the life of one of them by tomorrow about this time. You killed my prophets, by tomorrow I'm going to kill you." And when the queen sets her eye on you, when the queen makes a determination that she is going to kill you, she has the power of the people behind her, the power of the nation to accomplish that. And it becomes evident that Elijah realizes that he has to get out of that situation. He has to flee from that area. And so suddenly Elijah went from being a hero to be a man to being a man fleeing for his life. Look at what it says there in verse 3. "And when he saw that, he arose and ran for his life and went to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and left his servant there." It's amazing to me how fast the discouragement sets in with Elijah. He has to run away in verse 3, and look at what happens in verse 4. It says there, But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a broom tree, and he prayed that he might die. And he said, "It is enough. Now, Lord, take my life, for I am no better than my father's." Do you think Elijah understood the power of prayer when he prayed this prayer? This was a man who prayed to God and asked for it not to rain, and it didn't rain for 3.5 years. And he prayed again, and the rains came. And then he prays to God that God might just let him die because of the circumstances that he is facing. He is in great discouragement by this point. And so in a very short amount of time, Elijah goes from euphoria to great discouragement. From great victory to great discouragement. As we consider the rest of this context, the rest of 1 Kings chapter 19, I think that we can see how God intended Elijah to deal with his discouragement, and understanding how Elijah was to deal with his discouragement should help us to understand how we also can deal with discouragement. And so that's what we want to look at for the remainder of our study this morning, is the rest of chapter 19 and how Elijah dealt with his discouragement. The first thing that we see that Elijah is going to do is realize that, or that God does for Elijah, is realize that he needs his physical needs taken care of. He has to see to and care for those physical needs. And Elijah had to deal with self-preservation. The queen's after him. The queen's wanting to kill him. And so he has to get out of that circumstance. And that's what we sometimes need to do with discouragement. We need to just get away from the circumstances that might be causing our discouragement, to try to escape those things. Sometimes challenges arise in our work, and the first thing that we may need to do is to escape those circumstances and get away from them for a little while. Just take a break. Now realize, in what Elijah was doing, Elijah wasn't taking a vacation. It wasn't that he was just going on a vacation here and relaxing in that way. He was fleeing for his life. And in the same vein, he wasn't a coward. He wasn't running because he was a coward. This was self-preservation on Elijah's part. He was literally fleeing for his life. Now, we're probably, at least not in our country, ever going to find ourselves in those type of circumstances where we have to flee to preserve our lives. And yet sometimes we may just be facing some kind of a bad situation where we just need to get away from it for a little while. We need to get away from it so that we can do things that will help us to overcome the discouragement that those circumstances are causing. And it might be a situation where we can't get away from it forever. We know we're going to have to go back to it. We're going to have to deal with it again or deal with it further. But we just need to take a little break from it and spend time in prayer and meditation to help us in those moments. I see several times in Jesus' life where it seems like that's exactly what he was doing. That he was facing things and things were difficult, and he takes time to get away for a little while. One of those places in Luke chapter 6, and it says, "Now it came to pass in those days," speaking of Jesus, "that he went out to the mountain to pray and continued all night in prayer to God." There were these moments in which he was surrounded by people, and it was a difficult circumstance, and it just got to the point where Jesus needed a break, and he took that break to go away from those circumstances and to go into the mountains and to pray to God. The second thing that we see Elijah do is we see Elijah get some rest. In chapter 19 there in verse 5, it says, "Then as he lay and slept under the broom tree." He has run away. He has gone a great distance. He's gone into the wilderness, even a day's journey after dropping off his servant. And now he is laid down to rest and to sleep under this broom tree. Part of Elijah's discouragement had to be tied to his physical fatigue. What we see in the account is that he ran from Jezreel to Beersheba. And if I understand that distance, that's about 100 miles that he ran without stopping to rest, to sleep. And then he went another day's journey into the wilderness after he got to Beersheba. And all appearances anyway are that he was making this trip on foot. He wasn't riding anything when he did that. And so he needed to get some rest. Sometimes I'm afraid what happens is we become so consumed with life that we wear ourselves out. We become so consumed with going 100 miles an hour with everything that we do in our lives, with our work, with our extracurricular activities, with our entertainment, with our hobbies, and with all those types of things, that we book our time so fully that we don't take time to just recuperate, to just rebuild ourselves. And so the first thing we might need to do whenever we're facing discouragement is we might need to just step away and rest our body. Rest it physically so that it can begin to rejuvenate. We can't drive ourselves to the point that we destroy our physical health in those areas. You ever hear somebody talk about working themselves to death? I think there are instances in which people work so hard, even in the kingdom, by the way. They work so hard that they drive themselves to the point of even death, working themselves to death. The next thing that we see God do for Elijah, he's gotten rest. The next thing that God did for Elijah was he fed him. Pick up again in the middle of verse 5 of 1 Kings 19 there. It says that he lay down and slept under a broom tree. Suddenly an angel touched him and said, "Arise and eat." Then he looked, and there by his head was a cake baked on coals and a jar of water. So he ate and he drank and he lay down again. And the angel of the Lord came back a second time and touched him and said, "Arise and eat, because the journey is too great for you." So he arose and ate and drank, and he went in the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights as far as Horeb, the Mount of God. Elijah was in need of nutrition. He had traveled a long way without anything, it doesn't appear. Now God is going to feed him, and he's going to give him what he needs to go for another 40 days as he's going to go. I realize that's miraculous. We're talking about a miraculous thing that God does for Elijah. But it's something that was needed for Elijah. He needed to be able to have the nutrition that it took for him to be able to do what God wanted him to do. We're going to see in just a moment that God had some expectations of work that he intended for Elijah to be doing. That's where he was going to send him out, to do what he intended for him to do. And he needed the strength that came from the nourishment that God was giving to him. And so he rests, he eats well, to help prepare him to go back and get on the right track. And so all of these things I see as God targeting Elijah's physical well-being. And I think that there is a sense in which God expects for us to try to take care of our physical bodies, and taking care of our physical bodies is a part of making sure that we're taking care of our minds. There is a connection between how we feel physically and how our minds operate. There is a connection between the things that we eat and the way that our minds will work and our brains will work. I am a stress eater. Terrible stress eater. And whenever I'm getting stressed on something, I don't choose good things whenever I go into stress eating mode. And you know, one of the things that I notice is when I'm doing that, my mind doesn't work as well. I can't stay as focused. I'm not getting the things that I need to make sure that I can keep my attitude and my mind working in the right direction. There is a need for us to take care of our physical well-being as much as we can to help with the mind and the spiritual side. Paul said this, and often when we're going to 1 Timothy chapter 4 and these verses here, we're focused on the spiritual application. I think that's appropriate. I think that's the point of what Paul is saying. What he says here is, "But reject profane and old wives' fables and exercise yourselves toward godliness. For bodily exercise profits a little, but godliness is profitable for all things, having promise of the life that now is and is of that which is to come." And what I've often, maybe I shouldn't say often, what I have heard in lessons and studies of Scripture is people will go here and they'll make this point about how important godliness is and say Paul is making the point that bodily exercise is not important. It is only exercising toward godliness. The spiritual side. I don't think that's Paul's point here. Paul says bodily exercise does profit a little. There is good in that. It's just that the spiritual side is far greater. We don't need to ignore the physical side and ignore the connection that it has with our spiritual side of the things that we can do and make sure that we're doing better in our service for God. God took care of Elijah's physical needs, because that's something he needed to have happen to be able to go on and do the other things that he needed to do. It was a step in defeating the discouragement that he was facing. After Elijah eats, he has this food and it gives him the nourishment to go 40 days. He goes as far, the scriptures say, as Horeb. And there he goes into a cave. And it seems to me that as we read through this, that he goes into that cave and his discouragement just deepens. It gets worse where he is as he goes to this cave at Mount Horeb. But after a while, after spending a night in the cave, what we see is God speaks to Elijah. Look at verse 9 of 1 Kings 19 there. He says, "And there he went into a cave and spent the night in that place. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him, and he said to him, 'What are you doing here, Elijah?'" What are you doing here, Elijah? It seems that if I understand what's taking place, that God has pointed him to go to this, to this direction anyway. And in the process, he gets to this place and he hides in a cave. And now God says, what are you doing here? This is a question that is designed to challenge Elijah. It challenges his thinking about what's going on around him. But I want you to notice the answer that he gives there in verse 10. He says, so he said, I have been very zealous for the Lord God of hosts, for the children of Israel have forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left, and they seek to take my life. On one level, Elijah's answer sounds very righteous. They're all doing evil, and I'm over here trying to do what's right. But I really want you to notice that Elijah's answer is very self-centered. What does he talk a lot about in his answer? Me, 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 me. This is woe is me type of speech from Elijah. He's completely focused on himself and on his own plight. And I think it's easy for us to become very self-consumed whenever we're discouraged. We end up falling into that same trap where we're focused more on ourselves and more on how bad our circumstances are than anything else around us. We bemoan the circumstances that we're in, and sometimes we even blame God for the circumstances that we're in. We say things like, I'm doing everything right, and yet look at all these bad things that are happening to me. Why is that true? Woe is me. I want you to notice, though, that God did not give Elijah a specific or direct response to his complaint. What he did was he told Elijah to go outside and watch what was going to happen. By the way, anybody who's been in my living room, this is what Amy has made me a painting of this passage and the things that happen in these next few verses. And look at what he says, beginning there in verse 11. He says, then he said, go out and stand on the mountain before the Lord, and behold, the Lord passed by, and a great and strong wind tore into the mountains and broke the rocks into pieces before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake. But the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire. But the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, a still small voice. God works here to take Elijah's focus off of himself and put his focus back on God. To take his focus off of all the bad things that were happening and put it back where it needed to be. So how was that accomplished? It was accomplished because God challenges Elijah's perception of what's going on around him. He challenges perception about whether God's in control and still in control of the situation that he was in. God revealed himself to Elijah, but he did it in a way that wasn't anything like what Elijah would have expected. If you were there, if you had walked outside of that cave and you had watched the display that was taking place, would you have thought God was in the mighty whirlwind that came by? Would you have thought that God was in the mighty earthquake that happened? Would you have thought that God's mighty power was being displayed by the fire that was shown? It wasn't any of those. It wasn't what Elijah expected. God was in the still, small voice. God was in control of this situation. Unfortunately, it seems Elijah still didn't quite get the point. After hearing the still small voice, he still stood in the entrance of the cave, and God speaks to him again, and he asks him the same question that he asked him before. It says, so it was when Elijah heard it, that is the still small voice, that he wrapped his face in his mantle, and he went out and he stood in the entrance of the cave. Suddenly, a voice came to him and said, what are you doing here, Elijah? What are you doing here? And look at the answer that Elijah gives. It's word for word what he said before. And he said, I have been very zealous for the Lord God of hosts, because the children of Israel have forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left, and they seek to take my life. This is one of those passages that I wish I could hear the tenor of his voice. Because as I read it, I see Elijah being kind of almost belligerent in the first time. I've done all of this and all these bad things are happening. And now I wonder if there's more of a question in Elijah's voice when he gets to this one. Is it because of this? Is it because of these things that I am here? It's like, is he getting the point yet that he is here for a purpose? That God had something for him to be doing? And he's about to lay that on him. He's about to tell him what that is. What is it that he needs to be doing? What is it that he should be? What action should he be doing? Sometimes, I think we need to envision that God is asking us this same question. When we are facing discouragement, we need to imagine that God is asking us the question in that moment, what are you doing here? When discouragement is impeding us, when it's altering what we need to be doing and who we need to be, we need to look and see that God is asking that question of us, what are you doing here? Why are you wallowing in your own pity? Why are you sulking about this situation? Why are you moaning? Can you not see that I am still in control of everything that is taking place? And so that can challenge us to think about what we're really doing. It should challenge us to change our focus from ourselves and our own dire circumstances and put our focus more on God. Focus on what we should be doing for Him. And so that leads us to the next point, and that is, if we want to overcome discouragement, we need to get busy. Elijah was still focused on himself. He was content to just remain there in the cave. But God had other plans for him. Look at what he says beginning in verse 15. Then the Lord said to him, go, return on your way in the wilderness of Damascus. And when you arrive, anoint Hazael king over Syria. Also you shall anoint Jehu the son of Nimshi as king over Israel. And Elisha the son of Shaphat of Abel-Meholah, you shall anoint as priest in your place. It shall be that whoever escapes the sword of Hazael, Jehu will kill, and whoever escapes the sword of Jehu, Elisha will kill. God tells Elijah, I have very specific instructions for you. You need to get up and get busy with the task that I have for you to do, because this is a part of my expectation. It's a part of my plan. It's a part of what I am still in control of. It wasn't about Elijah. It was about God, and it was about what God was going to do. If we want to shake off discouragement, then we need to do the most important things we can do, and that is work in the Lord's kingdom. We're not going to be given specific instructions. God's not going to come and whisper in our ear and tell us to go someplace and do something in particular. But we've been given a lot of work to do through the revelation that He has provided for us. And so rather than focusing on ourselves, we need to change our focus to be focused on the work of the Lord. Focused on the work that He's given to us. Which means we're focused on other people rather than ourselves. Think about it. Evangelism. What is the focus of evangelism? The focus of evangelism is for us to go out there and share the gospel message with other people so that they can have the same hope of salvation that we have. We're not focused on us in that. We're focused on them. We're focused on what they need. When we talk about the idea of edification, the same thing is true. We're focused on encouraging other people rather than being focused on ourselves. We just recently studied through the book of Philippians, and one of the points that Paul makes there toward the end of the book is that you should be more concerned about others than you are concerned about yourself. And so when we realize that that's where our focus should be, and that it's so much better for us to realize that we're not the center of everything, our problems are not the center of everything, but rather that there are others that we can encourage, it's going to help us to get out of our own discouragement. You ever thought about that? The fact of when we try very pointedly to encourage other people, it provides encouragement for us as well. It helps to get us out of discouragement if we're there. And then the last thing that we see is that God told Elijah, finally, he was not really alone. All this time, Elijah thought he was alone. All this time, he thought he was by himself. And so after dealing with all the other issues that we've touched on through that God helped him with, he gets down to verse 18 and he says, "Yet I have reserved 7,000 in Israel, all whose knees have not bowed to Baal, and every mouth that has not kissed him." Elijah, you're wrong about feeling like you're alone. There are 7,000 reserved in Israel that have not bowed the knee to Baal. Sometimes, especially when we start getting down, we start thinking we're alone in our serving God. Maybe we think we're the only ones that face some particular temptation. Maybe we think we're the only ones that have to go through some particular trial or tribulation. I've heard people say almost as a direct quote, "No one's ever had to go through what I have to go through." Now, maybe we're not going to be in Elijah's position where we literally think that we might be the last person on earth that's trying to serve God. But we might be in a position where we think that we're facing something, some particular issue or problem that nobody else has to face. And I think it's important for us in those moments to be reminded we're not alone. Peter said this in 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 8. He said, "Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. Resist him steadfast in the faith, knowing that the same sufferings are experienced by your brotherhood in the world. But may the God of all grace, who called us to his eternal glory by Christ Jesus, after you have suffered a little while, perfect, establish, strengthen, and settle you. To him be the glory and the dominion forever and ever. Amen." And so Peter says, you need to be reminded that the things you're going through, there are other people out there that are going through the same things. They're going through the same trials and the same tribulations. And so we ought to be encouraged by knowing that there are others out there who are facing the same things that we have to face. It's not that we take some joy or some pleasure in knowing that there are other Christians who are suffering too. That's not the point that Peter is trying to make. The point is that we should gain encouragement knowing that others are facing the same types of things. Because if they're facing them and overcoming them, then we can face them and overcome them as well. We can be successful because we know there are others that are out there that are being successful as well. And that should really help us to overcome discouragement. Knowing that there are others who can help us through those times. It's one of the great blessings that we have in the local body is understanding that God expects us to be a family in the local congregations so that we know there are others there that can support us when we're struggling with difficult things. I think there are a lot we can learn from Elijah's account here in these couple of chapters. We can learn about what God did to help Elijah overcome his discouragement. And in understanding what God did to help Elijah, we can understand what we can do, the steps we can go through and use God to help us to overcome discouragement as well. First thing, we need to take care of our physical well-being the best that we can. Sometimes we need to just get away from whatever that discouragement is. We need to get the proper rest. We need to fuel our bodies properly so that we can stay focused and get back on the right track mentally to be able to overcome it. And then we need to make sure we're focusing on God and not focusing on ourselves. We need to examine our focus, challenge ourselves, think of God asking us, "Hey, what are you doing here? What is it that you need to be doing here?" Then we need to get to work. Be busy about doing the work of the Lord. Help to pull ourselves out of that discouragement because we're so focused on doing more for Him that we draw the attention away from ourselves. And then remember that we're not alone. There are others that face the same trials and tribulations that we face. They've overcome. We can overcome. If they can do it, we can do it. And we can use that fact to help drive us. Drive us in the right direction and make sure that we're going to come out the other side. Discouragement is something that happens. It's something that we all fall prey to. We're susceptible to it. But these are the steps that God says can help us to get over it. He showed it to Elijah. By showing it to Elijah, He's shown it to us. And we can use those same steps to overcome. So hopefully that's something that's encouraging to you, something to think about. This is, I got to admit, this is one of my favorite passages. And whenever I face discouragement, this is one of the passages I go to remind myself of these very points that God has set this up to help us to overcome.